It's time for some information and advice on your money. I'm Joy Cardine, and you're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Financial planner Kevin McKinley will tell us about a new online activity that might not be a great use of our time and money. He'll have some tips to spend less when getting more from the ATM. And he'll have some ideas on how young people should invest for retirement. But that's not all. He'll have answers to your personal finance questions, too. 1-800-642-1234. That's our number if you have a question for Kevin. You can also email a question to onyourmoney@wpr.org. And what the heck? Post your question, too, on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page if you'd like to do that. Financial planner Kevin McKinley is the managing member of McKinley Money LLC, and he joins us from our studios in Eau Claire. Hello, Kevin.
Hello, Joy.
So I understand, Kevin, you are spending lots of time with this new online activity that's sweeping the web. What is this new online activity?
The things that I do for you and the listeners, Joy. It's Kim Kardashian's new game. Ms. Kardashian is the 34-year-old erstwhile California resident, currently married to music performer Kanye West and star of the reality show Keeping Up with the Kardashians. She recently announced a new online game called Kim Kardashian's Hollywood.
Well, how does this game work? What's it about?
You download the game for free, and you can get it on either through iTunes or the Android platform. And your activities include shopping for clothing, working in a clothing store, going to modeling shoots, scoping out potential dating partners, picking up outfits and accessories, etc. But the problem is, of course, is that that can be very tiring. And once you get tired, you either have to take a break from the game for several hours, or you can purchase in the game stars, which can give you more energy and keep you playing as long as you might like to.
Oh, my gosh. Does that sound terrible?
It's worse, actually, than it sounds. I'm being kind here and charitable when I describe it.
But it's a pretty popular game?
Very popular. It was making about $600,000 per day in the first few days. It's rated on the various iTunes and Android platforms 4.5 out of 5 stars by the users. There are some estimates that it could generate as much as $200 million of gross revenue per year. And it's actually had a great effect on one of the other money and time wasting games out there called Candy Crush, which actually had $1.5 billion in revenue in 2013. Once a research analyst took a look at how much time people were spending on Kim Kardashian's game and how much money they were spending, they predicted that Candy Crush would suffer, and the company, King Productions, that owns Candy Crush, the stock dropped about 23% just in one day. Now, Ms. Kardashian's take from this game is estimated to be somewhere around 45% to 50% of the gross revenue. So in theory, she'll probably make about $25 to $50 million per year from this game, and that will go on with her estimated $6 million a year that she gets from her TV show and about another $20 million or so from other endorsements and products that she sells.
Think of, we're in the wrong business, Kevin. Well, other than the usual concerns about kids spending too much time, you know, online or getting too much screen time, why does this game have some parents upset?
Well, as you can imagine, she is not an ideal role model as a father of two daughters and a son that we would want our children emulating. Keep in mind, she did rocket to stardom on the basis of a released sex tape between her and her boyfriend at the time. And the game's message has been described as vapid. Again, you're just shopping around looking for outfits and picking out accessories. The amount of time spent is fairly high, and especially the cost and the amount of time spent. One of the reasons these games are so popular for as a business is because people spend way more money per hour of use on this than they do just about any other kind of activity other than going to concerts. They spend about almost $4.50 per hour of use on these kinds of games where you have to buy into it and to ramp up your productivity or your usability of what you can do within the game. And that, to give you a rough idea, that compares to about a penny per hour that people spend on books.
Oh, my gosh. And I still don't quite understand this goofy game. So you buy these stars so you can continue to play to buy stuff.
It gives you energy. And then you can also earn some points. Like, for instance, I, in my character, A lovely young woman with a nice bob haircut that I thought was fetching. I got to choose her outfit and dress it out myself. I was closing up my retail store that I work at, and Ms. Kardashian appeared at the door just as I was closing, and because I let her in after closing time to pick up an outfit that she needed for a modeling shoot, I was given extra bonus points for that.
There you go. And then I guess you compete with other people who are playing this, and whoever has the most points can say, I have the most points.
Yeah, there is some status to that as well, but it's just be living the life, as they say.
Yeah, and I take it you agree this is not a good use of time and money.
It's not great. It's not what we would prefer, but keep in mind that many women, and I'm sure some boys of a certain age, played a game called Mystery Date from Milton Bradley in the 60s. Do you,
did yes,
Joy?
I did.
Are you going to cop to that? Even the plastic little phone or the door to see who was there for your mystery
date?
Yeah,
I usually had the dud guy. I can't.
Did you marry him? Or
No, you didn't.
Okay, good. I'm glad to hear that. But if your kid were spending all this time, you know, fishing or hunting or playing chess or something in the money, we'd applaud it more than we would at this online game here for it to. So keep it in perspective. There are worse things kids could be doing with their time than playing this game. But because I've seen the success of this, and I always rather copy success rather than try to come up with it myself. We are coming up with the On Your Money lifestyle game where you'll get bonus points if you're – like if Joy is – her parking space is available, do you get bonus points for that? And for me, if the bakery has my favorite donut in stock when I get there.
Oh, there we go. We'll
should
have
be
to,
very
we're
exciting.
Going to brainstorm that one a little bit more.
Kevin... I just can't decide which sex tape to release to kind of get this one started.
No, don't say this. Kevin McKinley is the managing member of McKinley Money LLC, a registered investment advisor with offices in Eau Claire and in Madison. Kevin does not intend to provide personalized investment advice through this broadcast and does not represent that the securities or services discussed are suitable for any investor. You should consult with your financial advisor prior to making any investment decisions. That being said, if you have a question for Kevin, you can call us now at 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. It's time now for the On Your Money email bag, and a listener named Steve says, Hi, Kevin. I'm a 22-year-old starting my first job out of college, and I have to allocate into my 401k for the first time. I have no idea what or if I should contribute now considering the market conditions. I've been reading that stocks are overpriced and may sell off. I read about bonds as well, but since interest rates are so low, I figure yields can only go up. Wouldn't now be the best time to invest? Does it make sense to just park my first contributions in a money market or just bank deposit and wait until a more attractive option comes? Thanks and love your show. So what should Steve do, Kevin?
Well, I like how he did get the false praise in right at the end.
That's
I prefer
good.
It at the beginning of the question. But congratulations, Steve. Good for you on not only having a job, but realizing that you should start contributing to your retirement plan sooner rather than later. There was a survey that came out a few months ago where they looked at 3.5 million employees in their 20s, and they found that the average savings rate of those who were saving in retirement was about 7.6% of their salary, which is fantastic. And to give you an idea of why it's so good to start sooner rather than later, if Steve saves $5,000 per year into a retirement plan, let's say that averages a hypothetical rate of return of, let's say, 6%, and he saves from 22 to 32, and then he stops, all right? By the time he's 62, that money will have grown to $400,000.
Wow.
Which is the same amount of money he'd have if he were to start at 32 and then stop at 62. So he can either save for the first 10 years of his working life or the last 30 years of his working life. And under these hypothetical conditions, he'd have the same amount of money. Now, if he keeps going and goes from 22 to 62, he'll, of course, have about $800,000 by the time he reaches. What should be a retirement age even then, do you think? Way 40 years off of the 62, or will it be something where people will work until they're 93?
I'm guessing it might be a little bit beyond 62, but maybe if he's got, you know, 800,000 in the bank, he can get retired at 62. Do you think it's, is it okay for someone to start saving for retirement in this investment climate?
Absolutely, especially someone at his young age. And to be frank, he should actually hope for a big decline because he has such a long time frame. He's got 40 years. If he's working for 40 years, and then he might have 30 years of spending that retirement. So he technically might have a 70-year window of saving and spending in retirement. And he's going to be making lots of deposits. Again, over his 40-year work period, he might make 1,000 deposits into a retirement plan if he makes one every pay period. And so if the prices go down, good, because even if he makes the same dollar amount of deposit, he's buying more shares, and hopefully after he accumulates all these shares, that's when the prices will rise once he gets more money into it. So yes, he should definitely not be concerned about the stock market with this long-term savings plan.
So what is the best way for a younger worker like Steve to save and invest?
There is actually a process that people like him should follow. First of all, they should start saving in a Roth IRA. And they don't get a tax break on that, but they can pull the contributions back out whenever they want with no taxes or penalties whatsoever at any time. So the Roth IRA can serve kind of as a rainy day savings account. And once he gets 6 months' worth of his monthly expenses set aside in a Roth account, then he can start investing more aggressively into his 401k by putting more money into it. In the meantime, he should keep his conservative money in the Roth IRA so it's there if he needs it in an emergency. And then the 401k, he should try to, first of all, save enough to get any employer match. Second of all, try to get down below the 15% federal income tax bracket. That's noted on line 43 of his 1040. And for singles, it's $36,800 and $73,600 for 2014. Then any money below that is taxed at 15% or less by the federal government. And then again, invest very aggressively with that money. That could be all stock funds. It should be something that invests globally, not just in the United States. And try to make sure he finds the lowest cost index fund that he can, because a half a percent or more on fees can really add up over that very long time period.
All right, and good luck to Steve. I'm Joy Cardine with financial planner Kevin McKinley. If you have a question for Kevin about a personal finance issue, we have an open line for you at 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. This is On Your Money on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
I have no wallet. I have no wallet. I keep my cards together with a blue rubber band.
You're listening to On Your Money on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Joy Cardine with financial planner Kevin McKinley. Looking forward to hearing what money matter is on your mind. 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. Here's an email from Dan. I am 56 years old and I make about $50,000 a year. I'm late getting started on saving for my retirement. I have started a 401k through work, saving 10% of my wages in a medium to high risk portfolio. I have around $10,000 cash, which I would like to invest or put into an IRA. However, I am unsure what the best type of account is for me. What should I do? I hope to work until I am 65 to 67. So just getting started at 56 years old, that's kind of late, Kevin.
Better late than never, yeah. Joy. Mm-hmm. Good for the questioner. 10% of wages is a very good start. I'd like to see it bumped up to 15% or more if you can. And in terms of investing it, if it's the only $10,000 that the listener has, I'd like to have that money stay just where it is, in a checking or a savings account, because, again, you need to have at least 6 months and hopefully 12 months worth of living expenses set aside in a checking or savings account, or at least something that you can get access to fairly quickly and easily and isn't going to be gyrating around with the stock or the bond market. But putting that money aside into the retirement plan at work, assuming it is extra cash, actually does double duty, as long as they're comfortable putting it at risk. Because if you put $10,000 into a, let's say, a 401k, a pre-tax retirement plan, it actually lowers your taxable income by $10,000. And by putting that money in there and lowering your taxable income, you lower your tax bill. And for most people, that's probably about a $1,000 to $2,000 immediate reduction in their following year's income tax bill. So the best place to put it is actually to bump up those pre-tax plan contributions. But then, again, try to keep it fairly conservative to moderately conservative, especially in these times, and especially if it is one of your few dollars. If you do need actual savings, look at Series I savings bonds for that $10,000. That is the limit that a single individual can buy in a year. They pay close to 2% right now, and they're fairly easy to get out of after a year. You can find out more about those at treasurydirect.gov. Series I savings bonds at treasurydirect.gov.
Yeah, way to go, Dan. Yeah, you're right. Better late than never. Thanks for the email. Let's go to our first caller, Russ in Seneca. Hi, Russ. You're on the air.
Hi, guys. I've got a little bit different question. I'm hoping Kevin can shed some light for us. My wife and I, approximately 2 years ago, it'll be 2 years in November, purchased a second home as an investment property and subsequently had some marital issues, and it became her primary place of residence. We've since reconciled those differences, and she is now moved back to, I guess, what I call home. And so we've got the second property, and we're looking to liquidate it. And we're just unsure if because the home was her primary place of residence. I know that there are some capital gains exclusions if a place is your primary, you know, residence for I think close to 2 years or 2 out of 5 years or something like that. And so we're just wondering if it would be more wise to wait until 2 years have elapsed before we sell the property, or if there's really nothing to gain or lose and we should feel free to liquidate the property now.
Sure, Russ, a good question, and good for you for figuring things out and making another go of it. That's nice to hear. Let me ask you this. Are there capital gains on the property? If you were to sell it, would you make a substantial amount of money on it?
Yes, we would.
Okay. Define substantial.
Probably about $25,000.
Okay. And what's the rough appraised value of the home?
The appraised value, we're not sure. The assessed values have kind of bounced around, but right now it sits at about $140,000.
Okay. Yeah, here's the thing with that. That's great that you have that gain on it. You don't get the gain until you actually sell it. And my sentiments are that one of two things will happen which will hurt the value and the resale value of that home sometime between now and 2 years. I'm not sure you're going to be liable for capital gains taxes on it anyway. But even if you are, whatever you try to shelter, if you will, by waiting, could be lost to the market. And that could be because interest rates rise and people become less interested in buying homes, or the economy falters and people become less able to buy homes, or both. And if either one of those things will happen, you can find that $25,000 gain disappearing very quickly. And the good news about that is you don't have to pay taxes on it when you sell it. But the bad news is you still will end up with much less money than you would if you were to sell the house sooner rather than later, and then pay whatever capital gains taxes. And the date of the purchase was 2 years ago, you said, November?
Yeah, we actually closed on it, I think, when we looked at the records. It was in November of 2012, so we should be nearing that two-year point. And one other curveball I guess I should mention is that we have the property currently sold. We've got, it's not a done deal, but we have a purchase price agreed upon, and we're working on it's just a private party transaction, so we're just working with a lawyer to do the title work and everything. And so we're faced with the dilemma of, do we just let it go now, or do we let it go later? And unfortunately, the normal person we would ask for this is on vacation for 2 weeks. The buyer's very eager, and they'd like to get things moving if we can, and so we don't want to unnecessarily drag our feet.
Oh, it serves you right, Russ, for thinking of anyone else to ask these questions of. But luckily, I think you should actually follow through with it. I think you take the proverbial bird in the hand. And again, at most, you might be looking at a few thousand dollars of capital gains tax on this deal.
All right, great.
Thank you, Russ. Good luck. This is On Your Money. I'm Joy Cardine with financial planner Kevin McKinley. And next we go to Barbara in Neenah. Hello, Barbara.
Kevin and Joy, this is another host question.
Mm-hmm.
my husband and I are thinking of buying a house that could possibly be our retirement house that we downsized to. And so my question was, would it be better to take out a home equity loan on our current house to buy this house and then we were going to fix it up, or take out money out of some mutual funds and stock portfolio? I'm kind of leaning towards the home equity because my portfolio has been doing fairly well lately.
Okay. Barbara, you're not thinking of using this house to eventually split from your husband, are you?
No.
Okay. All right, good, because we've heard of that happening. And I hope it doesn't happen to you or anybody else for that matter. Well, a couple things about this. First of all, have you talked to any lender about what it would be like to actually borrow money on the value of the new home?
Well, I did talk to a lender yesterday.
Mm-hmm. And what did he or she say?
Well, we can do it.
Okay. Why would you, if they're kind enough and you are strong enough as a borrower to borrow the money against that very property, why would you go and tap assets you've already have at your disposal?
I just thought, then it's paid for.
Mm. But except it's not paid for because you've tapped equity either from your current home or depleted your portfolio to do it. I would much rather have you go and borrow against this property. It gives you a lot more resources in case the remodeling or whatever your life plans are don't work out as you hope. You can then go back in and borrow against the home equity or tap your mutual funds or whatever to pay off your life expenses, plus to pay for the payments on the new place. So yeah, definitely go in and try to get a 30-year mortgage for as much as the lender will allow on the new place, and that'll usually be 80% of the loan to value, and then buy it with that money, and then use the home equity first. And I probably wouldn't sell the mutual funds. But I maybe would move them into a more conservative allocation. So again, that money's there if you need it for either living expenses or to help you improve the new place.
All right. Thank you, Barbara. Happy home buying. It's time now for Smart Assets, and we have a question from a listener named Roger. I enjoy your show. Kevin's financial advice is always informative. Very good,
proof he doesn't listen very often, but thank you anyway, Roger.
But Roger goes on to say, he is puzzled about your recent recommendation, Kevin, that persons at retirement age should have saved 200 times their monthly expenses, less their Social Security and any pension benefits. The example Kevin gave means that they are withdrawing 6% of their retirement savings the first year. All the so-called experts strongly advocate that new retirees withdraw only 4% the first year and adjust it upward per inflation in succeeding years. So Roger goes on to say, I would like to know Kevin's rationale for his lower savings recommendation. So where are you coming from, Kevin?
I was promised that I would not be held accountable for everything or anything that I said.
People are listening.
On the show. Yeah, that retirement spending is a big deal. There was a guy named Wes Moss. He's the chief investment strategist at Capital Investment Advisors, and he just wrote a book called You Can Retire Sooner Than You Think, The Five Money Secrets of Happy Retirees, and he interviewed 1,300 retirees in 46 states, and he found that the ones who were most happy had a coincidental factor that they were spending money that they wanted to, but not spending any more money than they had to. And so the spending in retirement is very important, and the calculation can be very tricky. Again, for people who haven't missed this in the 234 times we've discussed it in the past 11 years, if you're going to retire, I recommend that you add up your typical monthly expenses, Then subtract any Social Security and pension payments that you expect to receive. And that remaining monthly figure should be multiplied by 200. And that's the amount of savings you should generally have in place. So if you're spending $5,000 per month and you expect $2,000 from Social Security and or pension payments, that leaves $3,000. And you multiply that $3,000 by 200, that leaves $600,000 that you should probably have in a lump sum in liquid savings and investments before you can retire comfortably. And Roger is right that most studies advocate a 4% withdrawal factor per year, and then again, adjusting that upward for inflation. But these are generally scientific studies, and they're backdated over the past. And those people who run those studies are not only smarter than me generally, but they have a lot more tools and data at their disposal than I do. But they do not generally have 26 years of experience of talking with people, not only on the radio, but also in my grown-up job, about how retirement spending actually works. And based on that, that's why I say that humans should actually spend a little bit more money sooner in their retirement than just a flat rate of 4%.
Well, I know I'd want to do that, but why should I do that?
Well, first, when people retire, they're more likely to have pent-up travel plans, trips that they've wanted to take and never have been able to because it didn't fit in with their work schedule or they didn't want to take the time off. And many of them have long-delayed housing, remodeling, or renovation plans, or they're actually going to buy a new house and sell the old one for it. So that's going to cause a little spike in spending in the first couple years of retirement. And second of all, they should spend more while they can enjoy it. You know, we can run all kinds of computer projections and spreadsheets. We're still using hypothetical variables. We don't know what will happen in people's lives. We do know that generally if they make it into their 70s or 80s, that they probably won't be physically or mentally able to enjoy things like traveling or maybe even to stand a housing renovation or remodeling that is probably long overdue. So you need to spend a little bit more money in your 60s and especially on travel as well. Plus, many of these things don't consider the factor that if you're a homeowner and you live in a house, that house can eventually be monetized if it is paid for and has equity that can be tapped if you need to move into an apartment or assisted living. And then this is something that's very surprising to people, especially if they've been to the supermarket in the last few weeks, is expenses and spending generally do not rise commensurate with inflation through mm-hmm. retirement, because most of what people spend money on is generally fixed. It's their property taxes. Most of them, if they do have a mortgage, it's a fixed rate mortgage, and they have more control over the spending because they generally don't have mouths to feed while they're in retirement. And finally, they don't spend very much on income taxes in retirement either, which is a very pleasant surprise for many retirees.
Yeah, that's nice. So do you have a retirement spending guidelines based on age?
Yeah, again, it can vary greatly depending on the person, depending on the year, the situation. It's not linear. But in your 60s, you can usually comfortably spend 0.25% to 0.5% of your investments in savings per month. In your 70s, you can bump that up to 0.5% to 0.75% per month. And in your 80s, you can spend 0.75% to 1% of your savings comfortably per month. And in your 90s, you should spend whatever you want. And this reminded me of a story. My grandmother, my dad's mother, was 86 years old, and she was living in an assisted living facility and a little concerned because her phone bill had gone up $4 in the last month and the rent had gone up another $20 or so. And she said to my dad, would you have Kevin take a look at my finances and just see if I have enough money? So he gave me her bank accounts and everything like that, and I took a look at it, and I said, Dad, if she buried her money in the hole in the ground, she could live to be 108, and it would last that long. And my dad said, Mom, good news. Kevin took a look at things, and he said, even if you don't make any interest, your money will still last you until 108. And she said, oh, good. But then what?
Good for her.
And I liked her attitude.
I do, too. I'm Joy Cardine with Kevin McKinley. Kevin is a financial planner and managing member of McKinley Money, LLC. If you have a question for Kevin, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. Jane in Warrenville, Illinois, has a question. Hi, Jane.
Hi. I have a passion for personal finance, and I'm at a point in my life where I can make a career change. And I'm seriously considering becoming a personal financial advisor. So I would like your advice on how to go about doing it.
Jane, have you listened to the show with any frequency?
All the time.
all the time. So you, what's happened, if you said, gosh, if this guy can make a living at this, how hard can it be, right?
No, actually, I have a master's degree in counseling. And know exactly how hard it can be to counsel people. But I love finances, and I had a chance to go on vacation and be with a friend who is actually in it within a business setting and works with businesses on this, and he was like, you would be great at it. You should pursue it. And and one of the best ways to make a career change is to talk to two people who are doing it successfully.
Or someone like me.
Well, but you know, you
someone
do
like you.
That having a counseling background, that's helpful, Kevin. I've often said that you're doing some counseling in your financial advising sessions, aren't you?
Yeah, Jane, this relates to your interest and your question. My father is, by all accounts, a successful business person, owned a chain of furniture stores. He's a business consultant now, still very active, and makes a good living at the age of 71. My mother's the same age. My mother has been a counselor or family therapist for 30 years or more. And people say to me who don't know how this job works and what I do, say, gosh, you know, it must have been your dad's influence in business that really helped you do this. And the numbers and things, all that certainly comes from him. But I have offices in Eau Claire and Madison. And both of those offices, in the conference room, there is not a big table and bright lights. There is a long leather couch and dim lights and public radio on in the background and a box of tissues on either side of the sofa. And those tissues, we go through about a box every few months or so. And so that ability to talk with people, to get trusted by them, and to find out what's going on in their lives and to be empathetic to what they're going through, whether it's good or bad or both, is a very important factor. So yes, if you have that skill already and the left brain passion for numbers, I would definitely recommend you pursue it. If you can do it well, it's really a great job. It is. I would encourage people, especially younger people who are thinking about going to law school or med school, unless you have a passion for those particular fields, if you want something where you really are helping people, you can make a decent living and see an effect on their lives, a positive effect, I definitely recommend that they consider becoming a financial planner. That's different from being a financial salesperson. Sometimes a person in your case can get drawn into, you know, a sales culture at a firm, especially larger firms, and many people are oftentimes disappointed because they're in a revenue-driven environment, and oftentimes when you have to help people, the best thing for them is something that may not immediately turn into revenue for you and the employer. So try to find a place that has a culture of planning and advising rather than pure revenue goals.
Yeah, does she have to go to some sort of financial planner school?
There is. I would suggest getting the CFP designation. I had it for a long time, and the training is good. The designation can be very valuable. It does lend some credibility, and that can be a good way to go. There are also a ton of post-secondary institutions that offer this kind of training as well. But I would start by interviewing around at different types of firms and see what the culture is, see what their offerings are for you. But no, there's going to be a shortage of financial planners in the future because it's just not the kind of thing that people gravitate to generally until they're in their 30s or 40s or beyond.
Okay, Jane?
Okay, thank you. Really appreciate it. Thank you.
Yeah, good luck.
Yeah, good luck to you. We will get to more of your calls in just a few minutes, and we will find out about how we can spend less on fees when we use an ATM. 1-800-642-1234 is our number if you have a question for Kevin, or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. This is On Your Money on the Ideas Network.
My mama told me you better shop around.
Well, we are going to shop around to get more from our ATMs. Most of us don't really pay a lot of attention to the fees that we pay when we get our cash. However, Kevin, you say we really ought to, right?
You bet. Those little ATM fees can add up. Those automatic transaction machines have been around since the 1960s. They really took off in the 1970s, though, in part due to a Wisconsin connection that we'll talk about a little later. Right now, there are about 400,000 ATMs in the U.S., and the Federal Reserve says that in 2012, $5.8 billion was withdrawn from that machine. There were 5.8 billion transactions, $670 billion total. That's about 23 transactions per year per adult in the United States. And the average transaction was withdrawal was $116. But some of the new reports are saying that this is something that people should definitely start paying attention to.
Yeah, so how much are we paying for fees?
The fees are definitely rising. They're up to about $250 on average, but they can range from $3 to $5. And then some banking institutions actually put a foreign fee on. You know how when you go to the ATM and they say, if you use this, you're not in our network, and so we're going to hit you with a $2 charge or $3 charge. If that's okay, go ahead. You pay that, but then your own bank may actually put another charge on you because you didn't withdraw money from an ATM in their network. And so if you look at something, let's say you withdraw $50 per week from an ATM and you pay $2 for every time you do that. Doesn't sound like a big deal, but it adds up. It's $130 per year in fees that you're paying. And on a percentage basis, it's 2 to 4 to 5% of what you pay. We would complain a lot if somebody charged us an immediate interest charge of that, but yet most of us just look the other way when we're nickel and dime with that little withdrawal fee.
Yeah, it bugs me when I do that, when I forget to get cash and I have to go to an ATM that charges me $3 or something like that. And it's like, why didn't I get that before I, you know, went out of town or whatever?
Right, especially when you're only withdrawing a dollar.
So what are some ways that we can save on those ATM fees?
Well, obviously, try to avoid ones that are outside your financial institution's network. Go to your own bank or credit union network, or use ATMs that participate in a no-fee system. And some institutions, I should say, banks or credit unions will actually reimburse you. So if you use an out-of-network machine and get charged $2, not only will your own bank not charge you, but they may even pay your $2 back if they notice it, so check with that. A better way, though, is to get cash at the point of purchase. Convenience stores, supermarkets, or the big warehouses often give you, $20 to $40 to even $100 back if you want, if you're using a debit card on it. But you have to make sure that that doesn't encourage you then to spend more money at the store than you already were going to. And the nice thing about this is if you do look at a way where you can try to reduce or eliminate the fees you pay on your ATM, you can always use it a way to not only track your finances but reduce your spending as well.
So how do we go about that?
Okay, so go for a month and add up all of your expenditures, write them down and where they went, and see how much it was at the end of the month. And if you're fortunate enough to be in a committed relationship with somebody else, that person is dying to tell you how much more you're spending than you actually should be. And so once you narrow that dollar amount until you say, okay, I'm spending $200 a month, let's say, on things that are important to me, I get a lot of pleasure out of, and are necessary. Then put that amount of money, that $200, let's say, in an envelope at the beginning of the month, and then just start withdrawing the 20s out as you need them rather than pulling it out of the ATM machine. And what you'll find is that if you have the ability to not use a credit card or a debit card, you're more conscious of spending actual cash because you say, hey, I've only got a limited amount of 20s to pull out of that envelope before the next time the month comes up. And you're better at manipulating your spending so that you don't spend it on money, the things you don't want. And it also requires you to know your expenses, which, as we've talked about before, that is one of the keys to becoming financially independent, is to knowing exactly how much you spend per month and trying to eliminate that or anything that you feel is superfluous.
What tips do you have for the safe use of an ATM?
Yeah, be careful. There's a lot of fraud and crime that occurs around ATMs because that's where the money is. Stay out of unfamiliar or kind of sketchy locations, especially street ATMs at night. Try to go into a store, a convenience store, where there may be an attendant there, or at least it's well lit. Look for loose equipment on the ATM. If the place you slide the card in, the card reader is jiggling around, that may have been put there by what's known as a skimmer. And a skimmer is a criminal that tries to draw the data from your card so that they can use it to take their own money out of your account down the road using the same data. Some people have even put little miniature cameras near ATMs so that they can see your card going in and then see what code that you pass on. So look around for those cameras if you're in an isolated area. And also make sure you cover up your your PIN number if you put it in. Put your cash with you right away. Don't wave it around outside and go, woohoo, $100. And take your receipt with you as well and take it home and match it with your statements when you get your monthly statement from your account so that you can make sure that the money you took out is actually what was taken out of the account. And then be very cautious, because if you're using a debit card, remember that debit cards actually offer less protection than credit cards do. So if you're not tracking those expenses and you find out 3 or 4 months later that someone's been using your debit card money, there's a good chance that you'll still be on the hook for it, much in the same way if someone had taken your checking account and written a bunch of checks and you didn't notice it.
All right. So looking forward to this. What is the Wisconsin connection to ATMs?
Well, the first versions of them were actually proprietary, meaning you could only go to a certain bank's machine and use that. And in Wisconsin, there were several individuals that were part of a consortium that created the TIME network, the Take Your Money Everywhere network. And that was the first one where people kind of agreed to almost a reciprocity between institutions. So one person could use another institution's bank. And one of the founders, the co-founders of that, was a man named J. Frederick Fritzruff, who was a Wisconsin native and a banker. And he served in the State Department of Development and the Wisconsin Housing and Economic Development Authority, along with Governor Thompson's administration. And I knew of him before. I never met the man, but he was very instrumental in the banking business and the financial transaction. He recently passed away, and as part of his funeral, he requested, according to his daughter, that the Dixieland Jazz Band played "When the Saints Go Marching In," because he loved the upbeat tempos, and so do I.
We'll play a little bit of that. Do you still call them time machines now and again, Kevin?
Of course I do. I even call them ATM machines, forgetting that the M actually stands for machine.
Yes, me too. Well, thank you, Mr. Fritzruff, did you say?
Fritzruff. First name Fritz, last name Ruff.
There we go. Well, if you have a question for Kevin, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. Our next caller is Tom in Stevens Point. Hi, Tom.
Good morning. Thank you for this show, Kevin. My dad went into assisted living due to Alzheimer's 4.5 years ago, and his house just sold in May. And I'm wondering how much of the money from the sale of that house applies to capital gains. And does the value or the price of the house affect how much of that is applicable to capital gains?
Absolutely. Is your father single, Tom?
Yes.
Okay. He probably has up to $250,000 of capital gains or of profits that can be excluded from capital gains tax if it was his primary residence when he moved out and when it was sold. And this situation that you're referring to is generally allowed to have it be his primary residence or so. So you've got probably the first $250,000 of profits are free from taxes.
Okay. All righty. Thanks very much.
All right. You bet. Thank you, Tom. Jill in Milwaukee is next. Hi, Jill.
Hi there. back in 2004, my father, being a man looking towards the future, put my mother and father's home into my sister's and I's name. The home was completely paid off. Both of my parents had diseases. My father passed away in 2010, and my mother just passed away this summer after a long illness. The house, my father gave my mother the right to live there. Both of them actually had the right to live there until they passed away. The house was probably worth about $350 in 2004, and we are going to be selling it for about $250,000 today because of the market. And I was just wondering if there were going to be capital gains taxes or income taxes on this house.
That's a good question. I always hope people pay a lot of capital gains taxes because that means you have a lot of capital gains. And in your situation, Jill, when the arrangement was structured to transfer the house into the different names, did you have a lawyer who helped you and your folks do that?
My father did, yes.
Okay. Is that lawyer still around?
They are.
Okay. I would go back to that lawyer And it depends on the structure of the arrangement and the timing of it to say not only if you have capital gains on it, but what the cost basis of the house would be in terms of calculating it. And it wouldn't stop me from selling the place unless there was something where you said, hey, we can go live there for a few years, make it our primary residence, and then avoid some of that. But I would definitely want you to talk with the lawyer and bring in a CPA as well, because it can be as little as nothing, the capital gains tax on it, or it could be as much as $40,000 or $50,000. So whatever fees you pay to an attorney and a CPA, especially if it's the attorney who structured the transaction in the first place, that's a very good investment to make sure. And you'll still end up with way more money afterwards than you would if you had never received the house.
Okay.
All right. Thank you very much, and good luck to you, Jill, and our condolences for your loss. Bjorn, I hope I pronounced that right, emails, I love the show. I have a Roth 401k on which my employer contributes 11%. I have decided to match even though it's not required. I'm getting my master's, and I will have about $60,000 in debt, $20,000 of which is undergrad upon graduation in 2 years. In the meantime, should I be paying more against my undergrad debt or continue saving for retirement? I am currently making the 10-year payment plan on my undergrad.
As a rule of thumb, it's better to pay as little as possible on those student loans because the interest rate is generally fairly reasonable in the single digits. I would prefer that Bjorn keep saving more for retirement, and then only if and when he gets up to the maximum amount allowed to save for retirement and has 6 to 12 months of living expenses, does he channel extra money to pay off those student loans earlier? Otherwise, the interest on student loans is significant, but it's a very small portion of the total cost. It's the principal that is the big payment. So trying to save interest, and especially sacrificing saving for retirement or savings that are accumulated for rainy day expenses, is not a good idea. Pay those loans down as slowly as you can, Bjorn.
So time now for the websites of the week.
Yeah, there are several different ways you can find an ATM network. AllPointNetwork.com, MoneyPass.com, and the credit unions have one as well. So we'll put links up to all those websites, and you should keep them on your phone. So if you need an ATM in a hurry, I did find out that Apple actually patented a process that would allow you to search for people in your area who have cash and then allow them to serve as your ATM. You would negotiate a fee and an agreement. Apple then would then keep a portion of that extra fee on top of it, and you'd get a small fee for giving cash to that particular person. I'm not completely sure we're ever going to see that in practice.
I thought you were joking.
100% serious. 2011, I think, is when they applied for the patent. You would just say, hey, does anybody around me have some cash? And people would get notified if they were part of this agreed upon app. And then they would say, yeah, how much do you need? And then you'd say, I have $60. They'd say, I have $60. It's a $6 fee. And then part of that would go to you, and then part of it would go to Apple.
Well, Kevin, I just want to put a little bug in your ear. We have had so many calls and emails, and we are leaving some people online who have housing and mortgage related questions. Sounds like that it might be time for another series on housing and
that's
mortgages.
A good idea.
Time now, though, for four more words before we go.
Spend less, have more.
Kevin McKinley is a financial planner and the managing member of McKinley Money LLC. Kevin has offices in Eau Claire and Madison. Kevin joins us each week at this time with information and advice on your money. We are live Tuesday mornings at 8. The program is rebroadcast Tuesday evenings at 9 and again on Sunday mornings at 7. If you have an email that you want to send a question to Kevin, you can email us at onyourmoney@wpr.org. Thanks to Bill Martins and to Justin Williams for production today. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network.